Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne Freitas.
And I'm Tosin Unifowakin.
This week, when exactly did Target know about last year's massive security breach? Amazon raises the price of Prime and ponders a Chromecast-style set-top box. Sony reveals a VR helmet, Google's smartwatch OS, and tech's greatest leaders, both living and dead, have an opinion to share. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com. All of our subscription links are in our show notes. Join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down, and write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. We'd love to hear from you. Our show's also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. I don't have anything in particular that I've been playing with, but Dwayne, you've been playing with something in the last week.
But. Yeah, I'm playing with like a million different PlayStation 3 games. Sony closed 20 stores across the U.S. These are Sony Play stores. They had them in kind of high-end malls and like other shops, and basically they shut them down. If you live in L.A., if you live in New York, there's at least one store open for you there. But if you're in other places around the country, they shut them down and laid off 1,000 employees. They've also done some more refocusing when it comes to products. Basically, I think they're kind of balls to the wall on the PS4 and Action Cam and so on and so forth. So what they do? They had a fire sale. It was an interesting sale because a lot of the stuff you'd be really excited about, the you know, like buying a TV really cheaply or a home theater system or whatever. Mm-hmm. They actually, when we got there, we were ready to do that. You know, maybe a TV for the bedroom, maybe something like that. But Sony had recalled, that is, they've told their stores to send back a lot of that stuff. The only TVs they had available were the display ones, and they weren't even for sale. So there was that. We looked for the Sony MDR-01, the super awesome noise-canceling headphones. They're like $500. Mm-hmm. They didn't have those. They had a couple open boxes that were 20% off, so a used pair of headphones for $400 isn't really what I was looking for. But they did have other headphones and other peripheral stuff and a whole bunch of games for really deep discounts. So I ended up getting Grand Theft Auto V, The Last of Us, Rayman Legends, and a couple other things for about $20 a piece, down from like the usual 60 or 40 or whatever to get them for. And so I've been doing a little playing, and you guys know I'm not like a huge gamer, mostly because the cost of entry is really high.
Sure.
But I think I can get $20 out of a game is my thing.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
I went out and I bought a couple, and I started Grand Theft Auto V. My girlfriend watching. She likes to watch when I play the video games, and then she's like, it's too violent, so she went to bed. But I did stay up that night, and I definitely got a few missions under my belt, and it was pretty exciting. In addition, I got the MDR-05s, or X-05s, mm-hmm. Sony headphones. Mid-range, usually $149. And if you're looking for a pair of headphones to like just kind of like wear around the house, at the computer, you know, you're not really, you don't necessarily have to, you know, these aren't like super travel-y headphones because they're not earbuds or whatever.
Yeah.
But they're over the ear, so there's no pain, less stress, really soft, and good sound. These are good. MDR X05s. You can get them on Amazon for between $116 and $150. Again, it was a Sony fire sale, so I got them at $60 or something like that. So if the Sony store is still open in your area, you might be able to get a deal too. But yeah, I've just kind of been buying, using a lot of. I spent a lot of money at Sony.
Nice. Hopefully you got some good use out of that GTA 5. It's, have you done the online component yet?
Not at all, no. I'll see what I can do with the online component.
There's plenty of single-player campaign stuff to do that you don't even have to. But the online component is an interesting sort of factor to that because you get to create your own character and join groups in sort of cooperative missions as well as like competitive missions.
How does it compare to the Microsoft experience, the Xbox experience in GTA 5? Does anyone know?
Well, with in GTA 5 on the PS3, it's fairly seamless because it's sort of its own portal.
You're not messing around on the on the PSN network or whatever.
No. It's all done through GTA 5.
That's great.
Yeah. Tosin, I didn't ask you if you were playing with anything this week.
Well, I think the one thing I'd like to note is I recently picked up Diablo 3.
Oh. Wow. So,
yeah, it's...
2010 it's said hello.
I know. It's kind of crazy, but I had actually played in the beta prior to the release of Diablo. But I was just not compelled enough to pick up the title at the time for, I believe it was like $40 or $50. And with a lot of Blizzard games, the price does not drop at all. So it's been 2 years, and as of a few weeks ago, it was still $40 from all sort of venues. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But recently there was a sale because there's a... there's going to be a patch and an expansion is coming out, and the game has actually temporarily dropped to $20.
Uh-oh, so, Amazon.com, here I come.
Yeah, Amazon had it as well as GameStop, and then Blizzard had it as well too. So I picked it up, and so far it's a lot of fun. I know people were not having as quite a good time with the game due to some issues in terms of the drops, the auction houses, a lot of the stuff of that nature. And Blizzard recently put out a patch prior to the announcement of the price drop that has alleviated a lot of those concerns and actually made it sort of a fun and thrilling experience for a lot of people. Now, I will say, given that there are currently also a lot of leveling bonuses, the game seems fairly easy, even on hard difficulties. But it's still kind of fun to, after a crazy day at work, it's fun to go home and play with a group of friends and just kind of have a good time. So I'd recommend picking it up if you haven't already.
Cool. Yeah. No. I.
It's up to $26.99. Damn it.
On Blizzard as well.
On Amazon.
I'm not a big fan of that style, that sort of three-quarter, isometric RPG style game. It's just not my thing, but I understand that it has been very popular. So,
well, it's a lot of clicking.
Okay, so let's get into some of the headlines.
I'm gonna record
this week.
That. It's a lot of clicking. I would use it as like a ringtone or something.
All right. In the days prior to Thanksgiving 2013, someone installed malware in his Target security and payment system designed to steal every credit card used at the company's nearly 2,000 U.S. stores. I was one of those people who was involved in that, who was a victim of that, I should say. 6 months earlier, the company began installing a $1.6 million malware detection tool made by the company's computer security firm FireEye, whose customers also include the CIA and the Pentagon. Saturday, November 30th, the hackers had set the traps and had just one thing to do before starting the attack: plan the data escape route, as they uploaded exfiltration malware to move stolen credit card numbers. FireEye spotted them and flagged Target security team in Minneapolis, and then nothing happened. In a testimony before Congress, Target had said that it was only after the U.S. Department of Justice notified Target about the breach that company investigators went back to figure out what happened. What it hasn't publicly revealed is, poring over computer logs, Target found FireEye's alerts from November 30th and more from December 2nd. Not only should those alarms have been impossible to miss, they went off early enough that hackers hadn't begun transmitting the stolen card data out of Target's network. The breach could have been stopped without human intervention, even, because the system's got an option to automatically delete malware as it's detected. But according to people who audited FireEye's performance after the breach, Target's security team turned that function off. Had the company's security team responded when it was supposed to, the theft had that has since engulfed Target and touched as many as 1 in 3 American consumers and led to an international manhunt for the hackers never would have happened at all. There's a terrific...
this is like an episode of Scandal.
Yeah, yeah. There's a terrific article in Bloomberg Business Week about basically they detail the flow of how the security failed from one step to another, the chain of failure, and the how the hackers did it essentially. But yeah, I mean, it was basically, it seems like a blunder of just incompetence, and their blunders don't even end there. Target's spokeswoman Molly Snyder says that the intruders had gained access to the system by using stolen credentials from a third-party vendor. Brian Krebs of Krebs on Security said that the vendor was a refrigeration and heating company near Pittsburgh called Fazio Mechanical Services. So essentially, they snuck in using essentially social engineering and stolen identification from a third-party vendor.
That's like crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I think when you see it around, or in general, most of the more sophisticated attacks will have some form of social engineering involved.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, getting credentials from someone lower in the chain or some outside source, and then using that to make isolating them and helping them, assist them to get their primary target, right? So it's you know, entrapment. But I will say, I was talking to about this sort of article and story with someone in the security sector, mm-hmm. just to really get their take on it. And one of the things that he brought up was the fact that often with a lot of these organizations, they're in those departments, they're way understaffed. So because I guess my question was, you know, why did they not, you know, respond to the alerts? And the answer was that, you know, usually they're way understaffed. There's tons of reports, so they are backlogged in terms of the reporting that they're going through. And, you know, it could be something where they just never caught up. And I think often in departments of this nature, you know, they do reach out to upper management for, you know, the staff and the ability to be able to, you know, better enable their job, as I think the article at least alluded towards the number of people that they had, and maybe there just wasn't enough. I will say that article is a very good read. You know, unfortunately, I can't say, you know, which parts are legitimately true until we hear a little bit more of the sources and information behind it. But it is, it's pretty compelling. And I think it's a good reminder to stay vigilant in all sorts of areas, not only, you know, for the large targets like organizations, but even on your computer when it tells you that it's time to update your AV, or, you know, Windows requires a reboot. You really should pay attention and react appropriately rather than delaying it.
Just throw it out the window.
I would rather know, like, right away, as soon as possible from a company that my information has been breached, rather than wait, you know, a couple of weeks and then have for them to like manage the PR behind it.
Well, it's not the management of the PR. They literally can't say anything until they know what they know. And that, like, the audit after the thing happens, the audit of what's been taken and who's been affected, that takes a significant amount of time. If they're rushing, that takes a week. But you can't say, "Oh, we've been hacked, world. We're still figuring out what happened." That's not helpful to anybody. I guess they could say Target recommends that you change your credit card, but again, they have to know how deep the problem is before they basically lean on the credit card companies, because those are the guys who basically indemnify them and you against this kind of fraud. to go and ask for them to, you know, create 90 million or 40 million, however many people there were, new credit cards. So if they were to say everyone should get a new credit card, and American Express, Visa, and Discover all had to create new credit cards off the cuff like that, that would cause problems too. So they really – it's not like – I hate to say it like this, but it's not about us in the moment. They have to figure out what got stolen from them, like in addition to like credit card information from you, and then they have to figure out what got stolen from you. What got stolen basically, because someone could have gotten into those systems and like done all sorts of stuff. And then they have to – you know, their contracts with the credit card company say, you have to let us know. So they have to tell them, and then and only then do they release a public statement. So the business has to be made secure again, or they have to know where the breach was, and then they talk. And that takes days and days and days.
Right. Yeah. By the way, I should mention that none of the information in this article came from Target themselves, because Target's still mum on the whole situation. This was the outside investigation.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to be talking about this.
All right,
anytime soon.
Moving on here, the price of Amazon Prime, which offers unlimited 2-day shipping and other perks for $79, is increasing to $99 per year.
If you're not a student,
yeah, the students get a like a half off discount, don't they?
Yeah. Thanks, Amherst.edu, for my email address.
If you're a regular Amazon Prime member and you're paying $79 now, you'll be your membership is increasing to $99. If your membership was set to renew before April 17th, you'll still pay $79 for that renewal. Memberships renewing after April 17th will be $99, and new Prime members will pay $99 per year starting March 20th. We were told about this. We were told that this was going to happen. Is $99 still a fair price? I mean, it's still.
The story is that it's going
is
up.
That is that a silly question to even ask?
Well, the fair price question, I mean, it's a fair price. Like, the shipping alone is expensive. Now, the thing you have to realize is even if you have Amazon Prime, comparison shopping matters, because sometimes there's, you know, Amazon buys a lot of things in bulk, which is why they can get such a discount on them.
Yeah.
But they also buy some things not so much in bulk. So there's going to be times where you find something online at like a Costco.com for $15 less than Amazon.com. That's because the shipping is kind of built in. But the difference is, you know, normally if you want 2-day shipping on anything, that's $30-something. With Amazon, they've been able to drop that to $15, $10, whatever, depending on the bulk that they've bought the thing in and the relationships with the shipping companies. So right then and right there, depending on how much you spend on Amazon a year and just, you know, having just, you know, moved into a new home, you know, there's a lot of stuff we're buying. That's it right there. And then there's Prime Instant Video. And that, I mean, like, their catalog approaches Netflix catalog and in size in terms of the digital stuff. And the fact of the matter is, you know, you also got you have that, and that Netflix is what, $8 a month? So yeah. It's a deal. I can't even, like, financially, it's a super deal. It's like a huge Groupon. They know that millions of people are going to do it, so they're able to give you a really big discount.
Speaking of Amazon, Amazon is reportedly readying a game console set-top box of its own, according to TechCrunch, and it'll have a form factor similar to the Chromecast. In other words, it'll be a stick or a dongle, as opposed to something like the Apple TV, which is, you know, a little puck. In addition, one source claims it should have support for streaming full PC game titles, and as such might be able to compete with consoles, including the Xbox and PlayStation, instead of just Android-powered living room game devices like the Ouya, for example. The streaming efforts will be akin to the remote game service offered by OnLive, than to the local streaming that NVIDIA offers through its Shield Android gaming console. The titles, which are said to be top-tier games, will be streamed from Amazon services at 30 frames per second, which is comparable to most online video, according to one source. So that is really fascinating. So not only is it set-top box, but they're also reportedly doing their own streaming game services. And like, if there's any doubt whatsoever that they have the capability to do this, I mean, Amazon Web Services powers Netflix. So we
powers
know.
Powers everything.
Yeah, powers pretty much everything. Netflix is one major example.
Almost every app you use in your cell phone with a cloud component has Amazon behind it. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things where kudos to Google for creating this new form factor, the dongle stick with the USB
right.
love. I bought like a little tiny USB, micro USB, what's it called, like a cord. So like I have the whole thing plugged into the TV, mm-hmm. and I have a spare USB plug just for the Amazon one, because the idea of doing PC gaming on the big screen without having to like hook up a whole computer to it, you know, like just take your laptop, bring it downstairs, and just go.
Yeah,
that's pretty damn sweet. What's cool about the Chromecast, and I think this device uses the same like paradigm, is that in many ways, when it's streaming video or whatever, it's your phone or whatever's talking to it tells the device to go out to the internet and do its thing. So when you're on Chromecast and you like hop onto Netflix, you've got a Wi-Fi network, obviously, because you're using Chromecast. The Chromecast is actually talking to Netflix directly. You're controlling it, but it's not going through your phone and then going. That's why the video quality is so much better than simply airplaying something. I don't know what the video quality is going to be on the Amazon thing, but I am excited because Amazon hasn't done a lot wrong when it's come to devices. And I think that's worth noting when this device comes out. And if it's as cheap as Chromecast, then we're going to be in really good shape.
Yeah. I can't remember what I don't think there's any sort of price point on this, but it shouldn't be that expensive, really.
Yeah. I'm excited about it.
Right. Like, Amazon already has a history of keeping their devices fairly low with the Kindle. The price point fairly low with the Kindle, and that's because we know that these are essentially gateways to the marketplace.
Amazon content, yeah.
Yeah. Sony has revealed plans for a virtual reality technology on the PlayStation 4.
Woohoo!
Yeah. Shuhei Yoshida, president of Sony Worldwide Studios, showed off a prototype headset at Game Developers Conference 2014. The VR system is currently codenamed Project Morpheus and will work with PlayStation 4. Still in prototype form, the headset uses a 1080p LCD, offers a 90-degree field of view, and it will integrate with the PlayStation camera for tracking and PlayStation Move for motion control.
It connects. How does it compare to the Oculus Rift?
That's a good question. And
that's the only question right now, right?
Yes, well. And the report from people who played it say that it compares favorably to the latest Crystal Cove version of Oculus Rift.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, 90 degrees doesn't seem like a lot. It's also showing you like a very different perspective than the Xbox Kinect focus perspective, where you've got the screen but your body can move everywhere.
Yeah.
Here the screen's in front of your eyes instead of like just, you know, you've got more devices, whereas the Kinect is trying to get rid of devices. So I'm kind of interested in seeing how these diverse perspectives play out in the marketplace.
Now do you think that something like do you think that this negatively hurts the Oculus Rift, especially if they don't end up being first to market?
I don't know. It depends on the Oculus Rift support. If the Oculus Rift gets support from a big guy, like if Steam decides to support it, if Microsoft says, hey, yeah. You know what? You work on Windows and we've got this x86 box. We've got the Kinect driver out there. Why don't we do something with you guys? You know, then Oculus really has a shot, but it really depends on who they get picked up by. I don't think it'll be hugely successful if they have to independently try to get their device and, you know, in front of people, and then try to scramble to get content in front of people. That's going to be problematic.
So,
even if it's just the PC gaming world, it's just not a huge market.
Sony is
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, Sony has stated that they don't expect this to be a consumer product this year. So they've got at least, we're at least a year out from seeing this come to market.
That's okay, because the PlayStation 4, if it's anywhere near as long, if the longevity is anywhere near as the PlayStation 3, they've got 7-8 years, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, the trick with these consoles is create a huge device, you know, in a couple of years, you release an add-on that just changes the game, literally. And then, you know, you obviously, you get your economies of scale and you drop out these smaller versions of the device and everything. But the big focus is, you know, keep on, Microsoft drops Kinect, PlayStation Move comes out. These are the things that get new people in there and get old people excited again.
I sort of wonder if, you know, rather than developing their own device, if Sony had tried to partner with, like, Oculus Rift, if they could have, you know, sort of cornered that sort of VR market, right? Because I think it may be difficult for Sony to... So if I were to play this out, I would say, okay, Sony now has their headset. What's Microsoft going to do? Microsoft, if I was someone at Microsoft, I'd be like, well, Oculus Rift works on computers, just as you said. Maybe we should partner with them, giving them sort of like an equal setting, an equal footing, rather than it being, oh, Sony has partnered with, you know, has cornered the partnership with Oculus Rift. And now Microsoft has to figure out what they want to do.
Yeah, I think it's the complicated thing, though, is that Microsoft, again, you know, VR is cool. We all want VR to work. We've all seen the Lawnmower Man. Yay, it's exciting. But Microsoft is focused on this Kinect technology. They've got 9 or 10 separate, let's call them lab projects, different implementations for the Kinect, and including devices that whereupon you put the Kinect on your face and it has a reverse Kinect functionality. So I don't know that they're going to rush to hop into the VR space when they've got this real-world, active game, talk-to-your-console, Star Trek-type approach. I don't know that they want to – whereas Sony's kind of moving into the traditional VR space. Now, Sony, they're Sony. Like Nintendo, they like to do things proprietary. I mean, like, this is the company that gave us the memory stick and you know, Betamax and all these things. They want to build it themselves. They build hardware. So just jumping into someone else's hardware is something that I don't see them like necessarily doing, which is why I understand why Oculus Rift has not been something that they chased down in order to pull this off. So I think that we have to think about the cultures of what they try to do in addition to what would be great in the market. Now, we all want Oculus Rift to succeed. I guess some of the Microsoft is interested at this time with their emphasis on the Kinect software, hardware.
Yeah, I'd love to see, I would hate to see Oculus Rift get rolled over by Sony and Microsoft and Google, etc. Any other company by... with the idea that they're going to sort of release their own instead of using what's already out there. Like, I love it that if everyone sort of said, okay, Oculus Rift is out there and it works, it's proven, let's just integrate their device into our existing services.
I mean, that would be awesome. The only company I see doing that at this point, though, is a company that's moving into this gaming space, needs to gain traction quickly, and is the kind of company that is smart enough to acquire because they know they don't know everything yet, which is the difference between Sony and Microsoft. Those guys are like, we know this space. This is our space. I don't need to buy another product. And frankly, the only company I think that would be interested in that, aside from the Steam guys, is Amazon, if this game console thing works out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like
I sort of doubt the Steam guys would be interested.
Right. I think the Steam guys are still trying to figure out their thing to begin with. But I think that Amazon is the guys who are ripe to pick up another somebody's stuff, you know, to acquire and assimilate.
It's going to be an exciting next couple of years in this space. Google is officially getting into wearables. The company has announced Android Wear, a version of their OS designed specifically for wearable devices. They released a couple of videos that show off what the watch interface will look like. In addition, Motorola and LG have already revealed their first Android Wear smartwatches. Several key features have been announced. Fitness. Google says you'll be able to get real-time speed, distance, and time information on your wrist for your run, cycle, or walk. Google Maps is built in, so you'll be able to get directions directly from your wrist. The company will also be using Google Now, so you get automatic passive reminders sent via the smartwatch. The watches connect with Android smartphones, so you'll get all the notifications that you want from whatever apps you have installed on your phone. And you'll also be able to say OK Google to perform voice searches like Google Now. And lastly, they say that the multi-screen functionality from the smartwatches that use the operating system is a possibility. You can use a voice command to cast a video to your Chromecast or get a certain song to play on your phone, for example. They don't have specific details on when we can expect to see more about Android Wear or what other devices will use them. But the preview of the operating system is available now for developers.
Yeah, so I got to say, as a Pebble owner, I'm excited that other people are in this space.
Yeah.
Here's one of the things that I'm a little concerned about, given what happened with the Samsung Galaxy Gear. When Apple and Google came out with these operating systems, they focused them on the smartphone. And that was a big deal. They weren't trying to do what Microsoft did, which is to sort of rebadge a desktop operating system into a phone device and thus have all the issues that MS had its first couple years in the new smartphone world. Google, when they went into tablets, they kind of created a tablet version of Android, but not really. It was kind of like, we got to do this just because there's an iPad out there. I'm a little worried that this watch version of Android isn't as robust as it could be because Google's again rushing to pull this off. Now, you know, Motorola has been working with Google very closely up until the Lenovo purchase, so maybe they have some access to stuff that isn't a close relationship means better development. Maybe it is tight, but that's where my worry is. I would definitely, as a consumer, I'm going to wait and see how these things work. Obviously, I'd like it if it worked with iOS, but I understand that it might just hang out with the Android stuff, in which case, you know, I'll find a way to experiment with it anyhow. But one thing about Pebble that I do like is on Android, you have incredibly granular control, and the watch is truly designed as a watch app, a watch operating system with its own app store that's focused on that. So I hope that Google can bring that level of focus. And the good thing about the watch market for me is that the idea that I have a sport watch, a going out watch, a fancier kind of watch like a Pebble Steel, or an everyday watch like a Motorola Android Gear situation, that's the kind of thing that makes me excited. Because as long as the data can sync from one device to the next, or it can all sync to the cloud, I'm excited about the fact that I can actually maintain different types of style depending on the application and always be connected via the watch regardless of whatever the watch is. These watches, I don't know how expensive the Android ones are going to be, but if the Pebble's any indication, I'm putting the Galaxy Gear watch kind of on the outskirts of this, then, you know, under $200 for a pretty nifty device that fits on your wrist and gets stuff done, that's a pretty exciting space.
You know what I like about this is that the Pebble sort of was its own self-contained device with its own self-contained system. The Galaxy Gear, again, only worked sort of with its own system, and there was no sort of there was no effort on Galaxy Gear's part to make this like a universal operating system. But the fact
it works, it's Android. It works with other Android devices. You didn't need a Galaxy device to take advantage of Galaxy Gear.
Didn't it only work with Samsung?
No, I'm pretty sure it worked fine with Nexus devices.
We'd have to double check because we have one at the office, and I was pretty certain there's a very select certain devices that it works with.
Yeah, there's a limited thing, but I'm pretty sure.
But the fact is that this is Google is creating a environment for like an environment that multiple that all devices can tap into as long as they're on Android as well.
That is good. It's kind of, I don't know, like, I hear what you're saying, but the fact that the Pebble is its own thing and can talk to anything is the strength of that device, not unlike the Fitbit. Wearable technology built by dedicated wearable technology firms remains, in my mind, stronger than a larger company trying to jump into the space because it's hot. And frankly, they're all late to the space. They're all late to it. Trying to jump into it because it's hot and then trying to integrate it into their own systems. This is what the whole talk about the Apple Watch. Just because Apple makes a watch and they have access to APIs that Pebble or whoever doesn't have access to doesn't mean that they've made the best watch experience, because you know this is not their core strength. Their core strength right now is telephones, you know, a tablet, and they have the resources to move into there. But I feel like, you know, again, you know, what Google did with tablets was not groundbreaking or super exciting, and it took a long time for the tablet app situation and actual compatibility to work out. I don't think that just because you've gotten a mobile OS, making a smaller version of your mobile OS on a watch makes the best watch experience. I think people focus on a watch experience, make the best watch experience. But we'll see when the thing comes out.
Well, I feel like this has something over the impending Apple smartwatch as well, because again, the Apple smartwatch is going to be completely it's going to only work with the Apple devices, of course, because it's Apple. But at least with this, we have an opportunity where anyone who creates an Android smartwatch and wants to jump into the space can have a unified experience.
The scale is nice. There's going to be a bunch of people, hopefully, that can hop in here and make a nice watch and do whatever with it, you know, have their own stuff. I think the App Store is really what's going to make it take off or not take off. Pebble has done a great job with their App Store, given the resources that they have. When Pebble first came out, it was kind of like, what is this app? But now you all remember that app, right? It was like, ooh.
Now
it's slick. They have the whole drawer thing where, you know, your watch only holds so much. You can throw an app. You can put an app away, so to speak, on your phone and then come back to it. I mean, that's really smart. As for Galaxy, if they can get developers to jump on there, and I think they will. You know, Runkeeper and all those guys are clearly going to jump on there as soon as they can. That's going to be good. Apple's Watch, I mean, if they take the watch to the level that they took the iPad with just dedicated personnel and development, and, you know, it's going to be very tight, that'd be great. I do worry about Android and Apple device, Android, you know, and iOS-based watch devices, because I just don't see those devices lasting for days upon days upon days on end the way some of the smartwatches have from others. That's what I worry about the most. The idea that I've got to charge my watch at night. I've got to charge my watch at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
I mean, I think the issue that you bring along is really the Pebble set quite the high bar, right? For, you know, being first to market and for just having quite a polished device, and no one who's come afterwards has really been able to match it.
So. I mean that's part of it. You don't necessarily hear that when you go to the wire cutter or extreme tech or whatever. A lot of them say smartwatches just aren't smart enough yet. John Gruber came out and said that the watches aren't smart because they don't have an internet connection on their own. They rely on Bluetooth. I personally think all that is bunk. I do think that Pebble set a really high bar with a device that is hardy, that they had great PR. The development of the device went up to the very end. They advertised the device at Bluetooth 2.1 EDR. We got a Bluetooth 4 device. You know, they did a great job with battery life, longevity, waterproofness, support when the original watches weren't working, as Andy knows.
Sure, yeah.
You know, they did a lot of that, and it's because they were dedicated to one device that's meant to work with everything. I like the idea that if I have an Android device and I move over to iOS, there goes my watch compatibility. I do like that, again, Fitbit, Jawbone Up, Y-Things, little personal device. These wearables, they should work with both ecosystems. They should be agnostic.
Sure. Did you see this Motorola 360?
Yeah, I mean it's cute. It's got a circular face. That's the 360 situation. Kind of reminds me of my old Mickey Mouse watch when I was a kid.
Yeah.
But obviously, like, way more awesome. It's an attractive device, which is what these watches need to be. They need to be attractive. We have to get away from this Google Glass looking thing. Pebble quickly came out with Pebble Steel to remain ahead of the crowd in terms of like aesthetics. I prefer the plasticky looking Pebble just because I think it's cute, but then kind of like, you know, silly looking.
But see, something like the Moto 360 is the complete antithesis to the Galaxy Gear watch, which looked like just some awkward.
It was chasing Garmin, I think. When you look at the Garmin sport watches, Galaxy Gear seemed intent on chasing that demographic. This is gear. You run with this. You swim with this. And I actually don't think it was waterproof. But, you know, you do all this stuff with it, triathlon, whatever. Whereas I feel like the Moto watch is taking the Pebble approach of this is just your watch. It happens to be connected and it happens to be awesome.
Yeah.
Galaxy Gear was like, I'm going to be, you know, ostentatious and awesome. That's why they created the Galaxy Gear 2 so quickly, because it wasn't either of those. It was only ostentatious. It wasn't awesome.
All right. Let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I want to talk to you about this week, we've talked about before on this show. It's The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon by Brad Stone. The definitive story of Amazon.com, one of the most successful companies in the world, and of its driven, brilliant founder, Jeff Bezos. Amazon.com started off delivering books through the mail, but its visionary founder, Jeff Bezos, wasn't content with being a bookseller. He wanted Amazon to become the everything store, offering limitless selection and seductive convenience at disruptively low prices. To do so, he developed a corporate culture of relentless ambition and secrecy that's never been cracked until now. It's sort of like a companion piece to the Steve Jobs biography, except for that we're talking about a living person and a person who is and more of a corporate culture and the behind the scenes of
Jeff Bezos is he's so focused on systems, because what he does isn't just creates. He doesn't only create stuff that's, you know, on his platform doing his thing. He's about like integrated systems. He's about, you know, Amazon's biggest strength is its fulfillment functionality. And these fulfillment centers allow for vendors of all stripes to get their products in people's hands, not just Amazon. So when you think about Bezos, you have to think about leadership that is beyond cult of personality. Clearly, his personality is a big deal. It's a personality that people like and they want to follow. But it isn't one that is, you know, solipsistic or directly megalomaniacal like what we read in Steve Jobs. You know, like, I was right. These guys were wrong. These guys don't know what's up. These, you know, it's about me. I mean, let's face it. That's Steve Jobs is rampant individualism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he, like, you know, you read about how he screwed this guy and that guy in order to get his company where he wanted to do. And then he got screwed himself. And then he came back and he screwed the people who screwed him. And, you know, there's a lot of drama there. You don't hear a lot about that with Jeff Bezos. You know, it's like, I want to get products into people's hands. Everybody here, you want to get your products in people's hands? Well, then work with me. And I mean, that's the kind of culture. You have to build a corporate culture that people really like in order to pull that off. I know people who work at Apple. The culture is not one that's warm. You know, it's one that could be warm sometimes in some groups. But overall, people are, you know, they're just very pleased that they can work at a company like Apple. Everybody should be. But they're not exactly like, oh, it's such a fun place.
Yeah. I feel like in contrast to Apple, Amazon is above all consumer facing and service oriented.
Yeah. And it's because they do different things. Amazon isn't necessarily trying to, you know, Apple's got to create a product that's going to wow everybody. And they have to be really secretive about that. They have to be CIA type secretive. Amazon has some of that. But really, it's about making business relationships, which means communicating with people and, you know, finding a common ground with a lot of different people in order to get all these products into your warehouses and get things moving. Mm-hmm. It's a fundamentally different business. So, yeah, I think, you know, it's cool to see that you can be a titan in more than one way in America.
Okay, so to get the Everything Store, Jeff Bezos in the Age of Amazon, or any one of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and the 30-day trial to check out their service. Even if you don't like the Audible service at all, you still get to keep the book for free. You can cancel and keep that book. So again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. We're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, anonymity app designers were so preoccupied with whether or not they could that they didn't stop to think if they should. Take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Anafawakin. In a 12-part Twitter treatise last week, high-profile venture capitalist Mark Andreessen attacked tech that enables, quote, voyeurism, which might start as, quote, naughty fun but ends with broken hearts and ruined lives. Though he didn't name any companies, he's obviously targeting anonymous sharing apps such as Whisper and Secret, both of which recently received millions in funding rounds. Andreessen implied that these social apps are tapping into the deep-seated human nature, and they're morally reprehensible and shouldn't be built. I'm going to read a little quote from his Twitter stream. It is a truism that how the software is designed deeply influences human behavior that results. Many software designers have done amazing job building social systems that encourage and enable positive human energy, but there are other systems in the past and present designed to encourage negative behavior, tearing people down, making fellow souls sad. Such experiments start off as naughty fun and end with broken hearts and ruined lives. In the end, everyone regrets participating in them. Since voyeurism is a fundamental property of human nature, such systems will always get users. But to what end and at what cost? I think,
and this is what Mark Zuckerberg was trying to avoid when Facebook came out. And this is what was going on in MySpace. It was a mess. That was the issue. When you don't have accountability for what you say anything you want, and you don't think about people's feelings because there's no retribution on you or your identity or your personal brand. This is not rocket science. I mean, I guess that this is a big wig saying it, but I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
But now, isn't this the foundation of the internet as we know it?
No, the foundation of the internet is democracy. It's democratization and that kind of thing. It's not rampant anonymity. Web 2.0 is all about accountability. Web 2.0 is about getting into a social sphere where the computer, instead of you trying to change your life to fit the computer was being more social around you and what you needed. Things like Wikipedia and Facebook show up, and suddenly we have people putting forth the best content they can. YouTube shows up, things like that. And you have plenty of people showing their faces online, talking, becoming their own personal brands. And that's the strength of the internet. If we didn't have that, the internet would be half as strong as it is today.
Right,
if it was all a question of anonymity, it'd just be porn and like bots and other like and bullshit MySpace, you know, BBS boards and things.
So I guess I'm not stating that it's positive or negative, but I'm just thinking not even Web 2.0, but Web 1.0. When the internet was first created, sure, you could have a predefined definition of who you were, but ultimately that could have potentially been a facade. There was nothing that necessarily kept that in check, right? It wasn't at least grounded on anything.
No, it was grounded. When you say Web 2.0 came out, you couldn't get on Facebook unless you had a college.
Well, I said Web 1.0. So I mean, like, before.
Well, that's one of the reasons why Web 0.0 crashed so terribly. While there were all these really crappy services on Web 1.0 that claimed that they had receivables coming in, that claimed that they had users and whatever, but there was no proper tracking, mm-hmm. and tracking involves identity. And there was no real business plans around these things. We were just like, our culture was just so excited about the idea of a web that we just paid for anything regarding it. There's no mistake that if the web was made for anonymity, then the web would have been a failure.
And I actually also think that even if there was no sort of anonymous presence, I think you'd still run into a lot of the same issues that you do where there is. So, for example, the one example that comes to mind are, for me in particular, I follow sports. And so one of the changes that ESPN had was, rather than having its own commenting system, it decided that they would leverage Facebook, sure. as sort of the commenting mantra. But reading through comments, it's really still the same thing, still the same sort of personal attack, the same sort of, you know, notions that you had at the time that, you know, I don't think it changed anything, to tell you the truth. I think people thought it would, but I don't think ultimately, from what I can tell, it has not.
People are still jerks on
because
Facebook.
I think one of the big things there is that, yeah, you know, like, you're using Facebook in order to comment and your name is there and everything. And like, ESPN's like, hey, I don't have
your
to manage
image
it.
Your image is there too.
Your image is there too. But, you know, I'm looking at my buddy Matt, who used to develop that kind of stuff for ESPN, moved on to NHL. And he's like, we don't want to have to manage that. Let Facebook software manage that. Who cares? And the fact is, when you don't have to interact with your people on a social network, this happens on Reddit all the time. If you don't have to interact with your social circle in reality, you'll say whatever the hell you want to say, right? Facebook, most of the interaction on Facebook happens on Facebook, which is why it works in terms of maintaining a level of general respect, because you're out there. So yes, if you're using Facebook to do, you know, commenting or whatever, you're going to get some level, whatever. But I guarantee you it's not as raw and wriggling as it was when we were all, you know, cutie loves you 453 commenting on this stuff.
Okay, but let me ask you a question now. A couple questions here. Now, do you think that the apps such as Whisper and Secret, which we've all played with at one point or another, do you think these are a direct backlash to the pulling back from anonymity that services like Facebook and Google have instituted in the last couple of years? And secondly, like, what do you think about the general question that that Mark Andreessen is asking here about whether it's sort of, if it's morally harmful to, because these apps specifically trade in anonymity, not just systems that happen to employ anonymous comments, but these are ones that were that rely on anonymous comments as its central focus in order to divulge secrets or reveal things that people can't normally don't feel comfortable with talking about in the open. Like, do you feel?
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
I
think it's definitely a backlash to a certain extent, because, I mean,
is it a
really
backlash though, or is it just like a release? I don't know if they're saying. I feel like a backlash is a fight against something that is in the establishment. I feel like Secret and Whisper they're not trying at all to replace or push out of the way Facebook. In fact, they rely on Facebook in order for you to get contacts and stuff. They're just trying to allow people to get something off their chest without the accountability.
Yeah, well, okay. I think I do agree there that it's probably more release, but I think it's a release in reaction to, you know, to the controls that we see in everyday environment. So I think let's even extend it further than this, right? So, you know, we've seen what Facebook knows about you. You've seen what Google knows about you and what, you know, both people past and present can find out about you, including employers, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, now we hear more about what the government knows about you as well, too. And so to a certain extent, it is a release, but probably for some people, it's also sort of a security blanket.
It's not, I mean, I don't know. It can't be a security blanket because it requires, you know, Facebook to get in there.
I guess an idealized security blanket from a mental perspective, maybe not from an actual, you know, physical or authentication perspective, right?
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I don't know. I look at Secret and Whisper, and you know, I've talked about it at length with my friends. Actually, one of my very close friends is tightly connected to Chris Bader, who started Secret. Mm-hmm. And to look at, you know, when you look at the description of what they're doing, what you have is, you know, people who are basically like, I want to be able to get something off my chest. I don't want crazy accountability for it. I don't even want solutions. I just want to say it and like have that be it. I want to put it out there. And by putting it out there, it's kind of like when you watch In the Mood for Love and he whispers a secret into a tree and he feels better because of it. It's there to get people to discuss and release their tensions, their feelings, without the kind of like onslaught of everybody and their mother saying, oh, well, you know, this is the way I would deal with it, or like, oh, this is a stupid problem or whatever. And I think that's what it's that kind of release. I think that's what's so powerful.
So I guess if you state it like that, just kind of,
I guess that's what Secret is. I'm not sure that's what Whisper is.
Yeah. Maybe playing devil's advocate here. Is it better to, well, I don't know. Is it better to release, you know, things that are pent up or keep them suppressed? Is that, I don't know if we can even answer that question.
And I think also the one of the points that Mark Andreessen is making.
No, I think we can answer that question. It is not better to suppress anything. If you need to get something out, you have a couple options now to do it. You could do it by talking to people in the real world. You could do it by asking friends on Facebook and getting a whole bunch of stuff. Or you could do it in a place like a Secret where you just want to say it and there'll be a couple of comments, but it's all anonymized inside of your social circle. So you know that the info is coming from people who care, because it's only people that they know. They just don't know who's who. But I don't think any psychologist or psychiatrist would ever tell you that suppressing your feelings is a positive thing, is what should happen.
But also, like I said, one of the components that I think Andreessen is reacting to is the sort of the cattiness, and not just the ability to express something that you might be repressing, but the but being able to say something that is going to be, that you know is going to be hurtful to somebody or harmful about some company. But say it in an anonymous way. Like, is that morally? I guess we can't really. I mean, it's a personal.
I don't know that you can legislate morals.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you can't legislate morals really. But I don't know that you can dictate. I don't know. Someone else's moral compass cannot be applied to the entirety of the internet, with possibly the exception of, I think, child pornography. Right. Like, we all agree that is morally reprehensible and people should go to jail for it. Sure. But after that, you know,
I think he's asking, is it helping our industry as a whole?
When he brings the moral question in, he asserts himself as morally superior. Is it helping the industry if someone has a complaint or a fault and they decide to say it anonymously? If it's constructive, it shouldn't matter. I mean, frankly, all these companies are getting anonymized data anyhow. If it's damning or non-constructive and no one stands behind it, then it's damning and non-constructive, but no one stands behind it. It's when people stand behind a damning phrase that you have to really deal with it. But frankly, if a whole bunch of people are like, oh, I hate Comcast, and they're not willing to say who they are and why they hate it and give legitimacy to the complaint, then Comcast is going to look away. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we all, you know, many people, I'm going to say we all, I think we all have a slight hatred toward Comcast. But you have to stand behind what you're willing to say. And I think that's the big thing here. Secret isn't about chasing down and damning people effectively. That's not, you're not going to get an effective FU engine out of an app like Secret. You're going to get people who are going to say, hey, you know, sometimes my mom says this and it really hurts my feelings. Or some, you know, maybe they curse, like, oh my freaking goodness, you know, who was this asshole on the road today that made me feel like whatever. Let's face it, you look at Facebook and stuff, saying anything negative at all gets you a lot of comments, gets you a lot of guff. In fact, one of the Facebook things we've all like been exposed to is the idea that Facebook is all about the positive in your life. Oh, you checked in at this great restaurant. Oh, you're on vacation. Look at these pictures, all this stuff. The minute you go negative, it all goes sour. These places allow for that. And I mean, I'm glad that people are thinking about it. I'm glad that he brings up these topics. I just don't know that his worry is warranted in forums where, frankly, like if people aren't going to stand behind their issues surrounding you, your business, or whatever, then they're not going to stand behind it. You have to figure out how you want to deal with that. If there's a lot of comments, then maybe you'll find some common thread and work on that. But otherwise, you just got to be tough enough to move on. You know, he didn't get there because people weren't saying things about him behind his back, right?
Speaking of moving on, let's move on to our next tech leader here. Facebook co-founder Mark Zuckerberg made a rare posting on his Facebook page to assure his followers that he takes government threats to internet security seriously. "I've called President Obama to express my frustration over the damage the government is creating for all our future," he wrote in the note, most likely in relation to the revelations that the National Security Agency has been hacking into computers and weakening security standards, specifically the information that was published in The Intercept, which we covered last week on The Drill Down, explaining how the government could pretend to be Facebook to push surveillance malware to users. He says, "To keep the internet strong, we need to keep it secure. That's why at Facebook we spend a lot of our energy making our services and the whole internet safer and more secure. That's why I've been so confused and frustrated by the repeated reports of the behavior of the U.S. government. When our engineers work tirelessly to improve security, we imagine we're protecting you against criminals, not our own government." It's not the first time Zuckerberg's been critical of the NSA. At last September's TechCrunch Disrupt conference, he said the government blew it, deciding how to balance privacy and security. And then in January this year, he said he worried the government surveillance means that the U.S. loses the moral high ground when it comes to advocating for freedom of speech. He implied domestic surveillance could bolster international oppression.
I mean, I don't know. I think it's funny that guy. I mean, like, how many times have we been on this show? Has the world written articles about, man, Facebook really messes with your privacy. Man, Facebook's taking up all your data. Man, Facebook's selling your data to these guys and those guys. Do you know what Facebook is doing? And then Facebook gets on, you know, the leader and says, the NSA is messing.
Zuckerberg protests, mm-hmm. doth protest too much?
I just feel like, okay, so like, obviously, because of what I just said, Facebook has gotten hit in the jaw several times and they've worked tirelessly to build back respect. Whether it's worked or not, I don't know. But build respect and talk about privacy and give people the functionality so they can control their information, all that stuff. So he's been slapped in the face a lot about this. And it's a sensitive issue for him, clearly. For him to bring it up, I mean, you know, he who's without sin should not cast the first stone is kind of what I'm thinking. But at the same time, having had his experience over the last 10 years, you know, he is one who can say something about this with some authority and credibility. Frankly, NSA surveillance makes the internet harder. It makes it harder for everyone to make money on the internet because internationally people are like, I don't know about those American websites. And that's got to be a piece of what he's feeling here. But more than that, this idea that, you know, I don't disagree with anything he's saying. It's screwing up our ability to have moral superiority. This is where morals roll in. Moral superiority of countries who have great walls of China or other, you know, Iran or any of these places where they limit functionality or they spy on their own people and they use that information negatively. We're lucky in that our government currently says the information isn't synced with any other sources. So the idea of becoming like a political dissident in the eyes of the FBI because the NSA saw something and they're going to lock you up and disappear you is pretty low, but still it's I mean, he makes a valid point. It's just funny that it comes from him.
Yeah. The pot calling the kettle black, as it were.
Who you calling black?
Who you calling kettle?
You, Tosin. I'm calling you. I'm calling you kettle.
Moving on here, the Wall Street Journal's former Apple beat reporter Yukari Iwatani Kane has a new book about Apple called "Haunted Empire: Apple After Steve Jobs." In her book, she says that Jobs told his top executives before he died that he had no plans to release a television because it's a bad business. The backstory behind this is every year Apple hosts a top 100 meeting, which gathers the top 100 executives, managers, employees. As with all things Apple, the top 100 meeting is supposed to be secretive. In 2010, Jobs hosted his final top 100 meetings. He sat in front of the room with everyone and said, "You've got Steve Jobs sitting right here. You're my guys. You can ask me anything you want. I don't care how dumb it is or how insulting it is. I want to make you all feel comfortable about whatever questions you have about the company." One person asked if Apple was going to release a television next, because there were already rumors all over the place that it was going to be Apple's next conquest. Yukari says, "Jobs didn't hesitate. He said no. TV is a terrible business. They don't turn over and the margins suck," said Jobs. Unlike
they don't turn over, as in like the devices don't turn over to durable goods.
Yeah, you don't replace them as often, I think.
Yeah,
unlike the iPhones, which are wildly profitable and replaced every couple of years, a TV gets replaced every 8 years and isn't all that profitable. He did want to control the living room, though, and he said the Apple TV would remain a hobby until Apple got all the content it needed. And just after he delivered those comments, he stepped away from his day-to-day role at Apple. Jobs' comments to Apple execs are at odds with what he told his biographer, Walter Isaacson, which is before he died, he said, "I'd like to create a integrated television set that's completely easy to use. It would be seamlessly synced with all your devices and with iCloud. It'll have the simplest user interface you can imagine. I finally cracked it."
Here's the question about that. When did he tell it to Isaacson, and when did they have the meeting? If he's thinking about an Apple TV device that is actually a television set that has all this stuff integrated, and he's telling Isaacson this, and let's call it May, and then he has this meeting in September, and then he dies in October, or let's call it August, and he dies in October, there's time where research went into it, and he was able to say, you know what, it's not a great idea, whatever. If it's the other way around, then there's some conflict there. But, you know, then he's also on his deathbed and he could have just been waxing poetic.
I'm actually sort of curious why this story comes out now rather than like...
Because she wrote a book so she can make a lot of money because she quit the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like this is the sort of thing that you probably report a lot sooner given, you know, people have been talking about the TV for years, but...
It's also important to note that in reaction to this, Tim Cook has come out and said that he feels that this reporter's book is, quote, nonsense, and that she fails to capture Apple Steve or anyone else in the company.
Yeah, I mean, I could see him saying that. He has to say that. It could also be that Steve Jobs said it into the top 100 because he was like, I don't want more people knowing about this TV thing that I want to do just yet, so I'm going to mislead whatever. The bottom line is that Apple could come out with a TV. They may not. What he said, the actual metrics, they don't turn around very quickly. The devices would be incredibly expensive. Sony right now is talking about, for the last year and a half, has been saying they're not making any money on their TVs, and their TVs are among the top manufactured devices around in terms of the TV space. You know, it's them, Samsung, LG, and maybe Sharp, with Vizio coming up because they've got the low prices. So I don't know that a television set's going to be a high margin thing when so many people are making it. I don't know how high margin the monitors are that Apple makes. The fact is they had the cinema display for at least half a decade before coming out with the Thunderbolt display, which is not much different. Now everyone's been waiting for them to come out with a 4K display. And the fact is you hold on to a display for a long time. A TV has become simply a display, and the turnover you can get from, an iPhone based device, like an Apple TV device, a set top box, the hockey puck, the turnover you at $100, I think many people are willing to upgrade it in 2-3 years, depending on what functionality is available on a new device. So I think his stats speak more than the Isaacson situation. There's also the fact that the idea that an Apple-based television set would need to be replaced, because that's what he's looking to do. He's looking to replace things every couple of years. Mm-hmm. You know, that thing has to cost at least $2,000, at least $1,000, let's put it that way. If a full-size iPad Air with 64 gigs in it, and cellular costs about $1,000, then an Apple television set with iOS functionality, that amount of glass, let's call it 1080p, let's not even call it 4K, that's going to cost at least $1,500. And then the idea that you're going to have to upgrade that is really not something that is mass marketable. So I'm not bullish on the idea of an Apple-based television set based on his own admissions and based on the fact that the Isaacson book, while, you know, official and sanctioned, you know, it was very high level. It didn't really get into details. And I'm also like the vaporware frightened boy, right? Like Google Glass was vaporware.
I've always felt that that when anyone at that high of a level has ever referred to an Apple television, I feel like they weren't necessarily talking about a device as they were a system, and that would be something that would utilize Apple TV, but do it in a way where the similar to, you know, the way Roku runs now, where you'd have these channels, except the difference is that Apple, using the enormous clout, would leverage channels.
They'd create a new interface for this whole channel thing. They have done that widely, right, on the Apple TV. It's just not as, like you say, with Roku. I mean, you're in there and it's like a whole different experience. You search for something and she's like, I've got it. It doesn't matter what it's on. Here we go. And Apple, right, would need those relationships and those those content deals in order to pull that off.
It's just really about the relationships and content deals, really.
Right. I mean, that's a big strength of theirs. Let's face it. They got the book thing, which is getting appealed in court, it seems. Well, it didn't get appealed in court, but people are now writing papers about how the Justice Department got it wrong. The iPad launched with all these publishers. They've gotten like every like 6 weeks or so, the Apple TV gets updated with new content providers. So they've got that down. I mean, then there's the music thing that they just completely took control of back in the early 2000s. Yep. So they've got that down. If they could pull that off, if you could connect the set-top box to any television set and have an Apple understanding, you know, combine that with the P-Cell technology we saw earlier this month, and Comcast, goodbye, right? In fact, that's one of the reasons why Comcast is running to become one of the biggest content providers out there, right?
Yeah.
People who stand to and the people who stand to benefit from this are frankly Disney, one of the biggest content providers and media owners in the world, between, you know, the Muppets and Star Wars and Marvel and their own brands. You know, being able to be on an Apple TV type device and get money that way in addition to traditional channels. And Apple and Disney have a good relationship anyway. I think that the big piece is figuring out a way to get people to get the content in an efficient and profitable manner, without this sort of yucky, super awful cable box lifetime suck interface that, you know, people hate. No one wants to flip through channels. I mean, that's not true. People like flipping through channels. A lot of content aficionados, people who are really into this show or that show or whatever, they want to watch good content. They don't want to sit in front of a device and flip channels. And I mean, I think we've all proven that people are willing to pay for that.
Ultimately, what you want is you want to be able to watch what you want when you want to watch it, and
do so commercial free if you can.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're willing to pay for that. You're willing to spend $15 a month dedicated just to Time Warner for HBO, right? You're willing to do that, and not, you know, you want to actually spend more money than you want on cable to get access to the content. Apple's done some of that with buying a season pass to certain shows. Because the fact is, you don't need to, people who live their lives aren't going to spend that much time watching TV. But when they do want to watch TV, they just want to watch what they want to watch, like you said. And if Apple can crack that, then, you know, they'd run the media world.
Yeah. And everybody wants to get into bed with Apple because of their success with iTunes. So,
yeah. My question is, if they have the cash, why don't they buy Comcast and just make it control the world?
Even Comcast doesn't want to buy Comcast.
I mean, they want to buy Time Warner, right? If Apple were to buy Comcast, and then Tim Cook makes a deal with like a Disney, they have access to like crazy amounts of content. They finally have a network that's all throughout the country, although it's kind of legacy, but it's a big network with, you know, 40 million subscribers.
Imagine the heads that would explode if Apple bought Comcast. Like, there would be so many conflicted nerds. We'd be like, well,
Well, they could turn it around, right? I mean, Apple's known for pretty reasonable service. I wouldn't say it's perfect service, but it's pretty reasonable service, and they have the resources to take it to the next level. And Apple is not afraid to get rid of people who don't work. Whereas, who knows what's going on in Comcast's mind? We just don't know what's going on. Like, that's the problem with Comcast. You just don't know. With Apple, we're okay with not knowing because they give us magical devices and services every couple of years. I don't know. I'm not saying Apple should buy Comcast. I think there's a better way to do it, especially if this P-Cell stuff takes off. But I'm just saying that, like, that's one way to control that space. If every cable box were an Apple TV device, imagine that. Mm-hmm. You'd have to leave. Everyone would leave the other stuff. Everyone would leave Time Warner or whatever other options they have. They'd lobby for Apple to come take over their space because they want that functionality. They'd want that functionality. And that's really what it comes down to. The functionality currently sucks when it comes to cable.
All right, let's move on to our last headline before we take a break and go into our video of the week. Once again, another tech leader, Bill Gates. Big changes are coming to the labor market that people and governments aren't prepared for, Gates says. Speaking at Washington, D.C. economic think tank, the American Enterprise Institute, last Thursday, Gates said that within 20 years, a lot of jobs will go away, replaced by software automation. Software substitution, whether it's for drivers or waiters or nurses, it's progressing, he says. Technology over time will reduce demand for jobs, particularly at the lower end of the skill set. 20 years from now, labor demand for lots of skill sets will be substantially lower. I don't think people have that in their mental model. He's not the only one predicting this gloomy scenario for workers. In January, The Economist ran a big profile naming over a dozen jobs sure to be taken over by robots in the next 20 years, including telemarketers, accountants, and retail workers. I think I've experienced the telemarketers thing personally.
Yeah, robocalls for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had complete phone calls with people that sounded completely real, except I knew that they weren't. So Gates believes that the tax codes are going to need to change to encourage companies to hire employees, including perhaps eliminating income and payroll taxes altogether. He's also not a fan of raising the minimum wage, fearing that it will discourage employers from hiring workers in the very categories of jobs that are the most threatened by automation. He says that when people say we should raise the minimum wage, I worry about what that does to the job creation, potentially damping demand on the part of the labor spectrum that I'm most worried about.
Yeah, I don't know. I look at this and I kind of think if jobs begin to disappear, we have two choices. One, we can do what Germany did with BMW and Mercedes and those guys back when the auto sector was moving toward robotics, which is they started building the robots that build automobiles, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's the fact that, frankly, the infrastructure of the United States is so broken that there are plenty of jobs. And even if those jobs are the operators of robots in order to put down better roads, rebuild bridges, whatever – there's still people to do that. You're gonna need people to do that. Now, you factor in population growth. Let's say in 20 years we're at 350 million people or something like that. There's a potential for a lot of people to be unemployed. But I think if he's right, and the tax laws do change to encourage employment and hopefully education, which is their biggest problem, can match the need for skilled labor, which is what he's talking about. He wants skilled labor to take over so that the unskilled labor, which robots can do, is gotten rid of. That's a big piece. And frankly, the more robots we have, there's a chance the population might die down. If the cost of living is expensive, populations get lower. That's why populations in Western countries always diminish. It's currently it's Mexican immigrants who are growing the population in the United States. It's not because we're having babies to grow the country. We're replacing our population value, and in some cases we're making it smaller because couples will have one kid instead of two. So I think that there's definitely some good stuff, some truth to what he's saying. I don't fall into the same conclusion he falls into, though, only because we've been automating things forever, and there are plenty of jobs that do go away. They tend to go away generationally. Mm-hmm. So you have less longshoremen over time as you get more automation, and people might move into early retirement. People might get retrained. the focus has to be on retraining people and on education being proper enough to give people skilled jobs, you know, skills and creativity, so we can have more entrepreneurs that think up other things. The 3D printing revolution is a perfect example. It's going to remove a lot of manufacturing needs in the large scale, but it's also going to help a lot of people begin to create a lot of things that were never thought of before.
Right. This actually reminds me of the different phases that we've seen in our, you know, the Industrial Revolution and so far in time, right? With the coming up of factories and just the changing in the guard in terms of, you know, where those skilled laborers need to reside and what sort of facets it becomes. And I don't think it's the time to be panicking for the rise of the machines.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, think about it this way. When the Industrial Revolution, as you mentioned, came around, a lot of people moved from the country into the city, and populations grew very quickly because people were living together and they were in the city and they were doing whatever. The Industrial Revolution led to more jobs, not less. Mm-hmm. Right? We have less people doing things like farming and more people working in factories. Now we're going to have less people working in factories and more people thinking about solving problems. If we dedicate the amount of minds that are currently, you know, doing the kinds of jobs that are going to go away to solving big problems, environmental problems, you know, space problems, yada, 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 then I don't see the decline of, you know, employment necessarily in the long term. I mean, the Industrial Revolution got rid of a lot of jobs. The car came around. Remember the car? A lot of, you know, people went out of work when they weren't horseback. You know, they couldn't, like, you know, run stables and do whatever. Right. But the car also, like, helped a lot of people get jobs on the assembly line. Yeah. Now, a lot of people say, yeah, those jobs weren't, you know, they didn't require as much thinking or whatever. But for a long time, what was good for GM was good for America, because they employed a ton of people and they paid those people really well. And they also, you know, they were the head of the pinnacle of technology at the time. I know he's a technological wizard, and that's even like a shortchanging him there. But I think that there's more to it than that. Okay, taxi drivers are out of work because machines can do it better. You know, the value there is in lives saved because machines are doing it better. And in taxi drivers, you know, some of them are going to help configure machines and some of them are going to move on to something else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he is – I will give it to him that he – a lot of the things that he's predicted about the future, he's actually seen come to pass. So
– yeah, because he made the future.
Yeah.
Him and Steve Jobs.
Like, so ultimately, what you're saying is Jobs' fault if we are replaced by software.
Or Gates' fault.
Yes, Gates' fault.
I don't – well, that's the thing. Back in the day when he was predicting and he was helping to, you know, make it come to pass, you know, he had a hand in it.
Yeah.
He's pretty retired now, and Microsoft is not necessarily on the pinnacle of robot tech. You know, I think that we'd all agree that Google very much is. I mean, he's not a part of that, and maybe part of this is him talking about the stuff that, you know, they never got into. I mean, they tried to get into the smartwatch a long time ago. It didn't work. I mean, Microsoft's failed a lot on a lot of things. You only have to be super successful in a couple things to become a Bill Gates, which is not to diminish Bill Gates, but that is to say that a company like Microsoft tries a million things, like the Courier, like all these other things, they don't work out. So while he knows a ton, the social dynamic that's coming, I don't know that that's so easily predicted.
Mm. All right, we're going to take one last break here. And when we come back, our drill down video of the week. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Come on back.
I am the modern man.
Secret, I've got a secret.
Who hides behind a mask?
Secret, I've got a secret.
So no one else can see.
Secret, I've got a secret.
My true identity.
Domo Arigato, Mr.
you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cersei. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anofowakin. Okay, so for our Drill Down video of the week, we have an introduction to a device, a connected home device that I think a lot of people who live in apartments and smaller homes, any sort of home without forced air, would is really going to find useful. Dwayne, why don't you tell us a little bit about this?
Right. So actually, Devinger brought this up to me today. He sent me the video. I'd seen the headlines. But basically, Quirky, it's a startup that connects inventors with manufacturers, and they crowdsource design. They brought the idea of a connected window unit air conditioner to General Electric. General Electric picked it up. And so this May, we're going to see a connected, you know, window unit air conditioner that's meant to behave a lot like the Nest thermostat device. Mm-hmm. It understands your patterns in the summertime. It figures out when you're on your way home through the app, and it keeps it. You know, it'll turn on the heat. It'll turn on the cooling when you're on your way home. So by the time you do get home, it's cool. And it'll lower it again. So you don't have to worry about, have I turned it on, have I turned it off. You don't have to be one of those people, because there are those people, especially in New York, who leave the air conditioner on all day so that when they get home, it's cold. It solves a significant amount of problems, because the psychology around air conditioning is as kind of as bad as the window unit design has been in the past. That is to say, again, people will leave the units on all day long in order to keep their apartment cool. They'll leave the apartment, come back, all this stuff, and the device will just kind of be running. Or, you know, they get home and it's crazy hot, so they are frustrated and they just blast it or whatever. This device is meant to keep your house or the room that it's in a certain temperature. And, you know, it's 8,000 BTUs. It's a solid device, but what's really cool about it is that, you know, again, Quirky, their whole shtick is that they think the inventors should invent and they shouldn't have to think about the manufacturing processes or the business decisions or whatever. They should be able to figure out a design. They should be able to put it together and present it. And it's Quirky's job to get that awesome invention, which is voted on by their community and their experts. It's Quirky's job to get that design up and running. And when it is up and running, that inventor gets compensated. So by crowdsourcing design and by working with manufacturers that know the business and the manufacturing world, their hope is to create a whole lot more cool things without some of the hiccups that you find in Kickstarter or Indiegogo campaigns where, oh, I got this thing and the software doesn't work yet. Oh, I got this thing and it's not supported. Oh, I got this thing and it actually didn't work out, so I'm getting my money back and I'm not getting that device. The whole point of Quirky is to get around that. And by getting GE, which is, you know, old school, you know, really, really well-trained group of guys and girls when it comes to manufacturing home appliances, getting those guys to sign on a device like this, that's a pretty big deal. You know, there's a lot of – they've got a whole machine when it comes to putting devices together, product testing, and finally product marketing and getting the thing out there and in the hands of people and in stores. So, you know, it's kind of like the hybridization of the whole Kickstarter, Indiegogo, crowdfunded movement. Yeah. So that's what's kind of cool about this. So, I mean, take a look. It's the kind of device that I feel like people will look at it and they'll be like, how come we didn't have this before? This makes so much sense, which is kind of what you want in a new device.
The Quirky Eros through GE.
Quirky plus GE, I think, is what it says on the front.
Yeah. So cool. All right. It looks slick. It looks pretty slick. Like my one sort of qualm with it, and I mentioned this before the show, is it feels a little bit like tacked on home connectivity as opposed to something organic like the Nest. But you know, any sort of integration is good. And the other problem that I had with this, which we discussed before the show, is that it relies on a yet another sort of connectivity system. And the issue is that I feel like there should be some, like, one unified standard for all of these home connectivity system so that you don't have to add yet another thing to your keychain.
Like who? Like what's a company that you think could possibly be solving this problem for us right now based in Boulder?
Well, you mentioned Revolve. And I think you may have mentioned it on the show before. Revolve essentially does this. What does that is they're a central hub, the easiest way to think of it is a Harmony remote for home connectivity systems. So they a central hub that takes all of these different systems and sort of creates a smart
a macro.
Recipe. Thank you. Yes, a macro for these. So right.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big trick is once these things come out, and this is why you get a little worried about GE. GE is not known for things like APIs, but these devices really need super secure APIs so that you can use some sort of integration software in order to cloud-based integration software in order to gain access to all these things. But a big piece of it is security. You don't want people hacking into your house, right?
Right.
So for right now, I think most users who are excited are going to have a folder on their iOS device or a page on their Android device or a folder, depending on which GUI you have, that's going to have all their little apps. And that's the apps that control the house. I mean, that's what I have right now until I pick up one of these Revolve things and see how it works. But yeah, I think that it seems a little tacked on at first, but it's an air conditioner. It has certain things that are very air conditionery about it. It's white, for instance. it's that kind of thing. But it seems like it's a well designed and high quality piece of work. So that's what's exciting about it.
All right, that's it for our show. With the exception of going around the table here, I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work on outside of the drill down?
You can always find me on twitter.com/DwayneD or gplus.to/DwayneD. And you can always show up here on the drill down and listen to what I have to say.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online when you're not here on the show?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321, and you can also find my R2D2 blog at toastr2d2.tumblr.com.
I like that blog.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. I love seeing your weekly updates and seeing where you are. Like I noticed you did like a painting thing recently. Like you painted parts.
Yeah, no, I learned how to spray paint and sanding as well as the entire process. So a lot of photos that documented the sort of trip with a bit of scrap aluminum. And
that painting thing, did you do that in your house or did you go to like a special painting, because some people do, DIY projects in shared spaces.
Right. So this is actually so I live in an apartment.
Yeah.
And unfortunately don't really have the space, but one of my friends has this open car garage, mm-hmm. Three slot garages, and one of the spots was not being used. And so we actually made this paint room, and you can probably see from all, if you look at some of the earlier posts, I had a post on with images of how we created it, but we basically used like polythene sheeting on the sides and coated the ground, and it looks like a room right out of Dexter.
It totally does.
Amazing.
It looks
as well
looks
as
like a kill room
for it. So it's kind of funny when we go in through the like it has like these flaps like you'd see in like a meat locker when we go in with like our headgear and all that sort of protection.
I was expecting to see a body on the slab and like pictures of their victims on the pasted on the walls.
You just see cars.
you just see cars, metal, and a lot of blue paint. But yeah, no, we created that surface in a garage, and it's actually it's working out pretty well.
Do you keep the door open, like the bay door, the car bay door open?
It's since it slots, it allows us to walk out, but we keep it contained so that no spray mist gets outside on other things.
All right. As for me, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com and look up Mr. Babyman on Google.
Just look it up.
Yeah, just look it up. Just Google it.
Babyman. It's like, how can you forget that?
Yeah, all my social links are there. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about on the Drill Down or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. You can let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.